Hi, this is Steve Poore, and you're listening to Pioneers and Pathfinders. With this episode, we mark the third year anniversary of Pioneers and Pathfinders. I want to thank each of you for listening in on the conversations we've had with our exceptional guests over that time. I would also like to thank our team at SciFarth who helped put the program together. I would like to pause for a moment and note the contribution of my friend and colleague, Molly Porter, who got this podcast up and running. We lost Molly this year, but it was her creativity and determination that got us started and still underlies our efforts. I will be forever grateful to her. Thank you, Molly. Now, nothing could mark the anniversary better than to welcome back to the podcast a thought leader in the legal profession and legal education, Kat Moon. Kat is lecturer and director of innovation design at Vanderbilt University Law School. Since Kat last joined us a couple of years ago, she's founded VAIL, the Vanderbilt AI and Law Lab, which she also co-directs. In this program, she collaborates with professionals across various disciplines to improve legal practice by exploring and experimenting at the intersection of generative AI, legal education, law practice, and access to justice. Today, Kat discusses the resilience of her law students, the challenges ahead for lawyer training, her fascinating work with VAIL, and developing competency in the use of generative AI. As always, thanks for listening. I'm joined today by the one and only Kat Moon, Director of Innovation and Design at Vanderbilt University Law School, among other things. Kat, thanks for returning to chat with us.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's great to be here.
It's great to talk to you again. The last time you were on the show was a few years ago, and we were in the middle of the pandemic, and we were talking about virtual learning and what you missed from the pandemic. I assume we've recovered from that. I'm curious as to how you assess the impact of the pandemic on students' learning now that they've had a few years away from it.
So my current 3L students, so third year students, came into law school really in the midst of the pandemic. And they will tell you it absolutely has impacted their experience. So I think we could look at experience and learning as really two different things. My sense is that their learning has continued to be very robust and they've learned what they've needed to learn. I think their experience through the pandemic and since, and as a result, is definitely different than the before times, as we've come to call them. So it's really hard to say what the ongoing impact is. I think, as you know, I'm a glass half full kind of person. You know, I really embrace the human-centered design mindset of optimism. And so my hope is that we're still continuing to be very reflective and intentional and think about how we're going forward and coming out of, you know, this experience that we all unfortunately had together. So I think there are some things that changed for the good that have persisted. And so I think that's a positive. And, you know, we can't undo the experience, right? We've really just got to make the best of what the experience was and kind of where it brought us. And, you know, I see my students being incredibly resilient and I think still very positive. They're very excited. All my students this semester are third year students and they are so excited to join our profession. And so I think that's really a testament to their resiliency of going through that less than ideal experience of law school during the pandemic.
If you were talking to one of your students, soon to be employers, whether it's a law firm or a government agency or whatever it might be, are there gaps that the employers ought to be aware of? Obviously, I'm asking with a broad brush and every individual is different. But are there, as a general proposition, are there gaps that the employer ought to be aware of that they may need to fill that they aren't used to in encountering?
My observation is I don't think the gaps are really any different than they have been. There are definitely persistent gaps between what students leave law school prepared to do and what the expectations are for doing work, doing legal work in the real world. I don't know that those gaps have really changed And so I believe the things firms should be doing to prepare new graduates for the practice and to thrive in the practice. And by thrive, I mean holistically, right? Do great work for their employer and also be happy, healthy humans. I think all three things can be achieved. I think the things that employers should be doing are really no different than before the pandemic, honestly. I think they've always needed to mind those gaps. And this isn't necessarily responsive to your question, so I hope you will give me a little bit of latitude. But I do want to share that in my human-centered design course that I'm teaching this semester, which is called Legal Problem Solving, the students just completed their persona exercise. And so a persona is a tool that is often used in service and product design. So it's meant to represent a, quote, typical user of a service or a product. And organizations use this persona to develop empathy and create user experiences and services and products that would appeal to and meet the needs of the persona, right? So I have students create their own persona. So it is partly an exercise to give them experience using the persona because we do that with our real world collaborative partners in the class projects. It's also an opportunity for them to really reflect on who they are at this point and where they're going. And so they create their persona as a about to be young lawyer entering, for the most part, a law firm. Most of my students go straight into a corporate law firm. And it's really interesting because the persona is all this information that the organization needs to know about you as a user, as a participant in their system, right? And so the students put all the information in their persona that they want their firms to know about them with the premise that if the firms just really understood their people a little bit better and had a deeper sense of empathy, then ways of working and culture could actually be more intentionally designed to work well for more participants in that culture. And so it would be interesting, actually, I think, to ask my students to directly reflect on the question you just posed to me as part of their persona consideration. I do think my students very much want to understand where those gaps are in their own, you know, competencies, experience, understandings, so that they can be prepared to, you know, figure out themselves how they mind those gaps and how they can get what they need in order to thrive in the environments they're going into. So thank you for allowing me to take that little gravel road. I find the intersection interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And let's keep going down that road because we seem to talk to each other at interesting moments. A year into the pandemic was the last time we talked. And now we're a year into the world of generative AI. And I know you just launched the Vanderbilt AI and Law Lab, and I want to talk more about that and hear about that and what work you're doing. But let's stick on the gap question. As you look at the impact of generative AI technologies on the profession, whether it's the education side of the profession or whether it's the practicing side of the profession, does it mean the same thing to be a lawyer in a world of generative AI, or will it mean the same thing to be a lawyer?
Do we agree on what it means to be a lawyer before
the world? I'm not sure we do. Well, I think that's a great question, and I think the profession tends to, over the years, has tended to emphasize the tasks components of it: the research, the writing, the looking at documents, and has not trained or developed people on the human side, the empathy, the relationship building, which are all necessary components to being a successful lawyer, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm curious as to whether, A, you agree with that. Let's start there. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I do. I think that goes directly to the gaps that I was referring to earlier. So absolutely. Well, so what's interesting, actually, is that research consistently shows that when asked, and this is historically going back many decades, practicing lawyers will actually identify those very human skills as the most, if not almost the most important. And so consistently, the more kind of rote technically legal skills are really deemed a given, right? If you get through law school and do reasonably well and pass the bar, it's essentially assumed that you are able to do legal research. You're able to do a proficient level of writing in a technically legal style and so on. And folks, again, consistently point to those human skills as really the differentiating factors between lawyers who excel and lawyers who don't, and that they deem them like valuable and they look for them when they are hiring associates. So it's really interesting to me that this data exists, and assuming it's accurate, we continue to really disregard it with respect to the law school curriculum in terms of modernizing the curriculum, right? So we are in a system, legal education system, as well as our justice systems, that are products of the Industrial Revolution, a time that ended more than 100 years ago. And while certainly things do look somewhat different now, the core structure and how we do things is primarily the same. And, you know, you referenced this age of AI and where we are now, certainly the world around us, it's indisputable at this point that the world around us looks very different. But there's this, you know, persistent really unwillingness to modernize how we're training lawyers. And so I think the gaps that are frankly because of where we are now and because of the pressure that technology is placing on not just our profession, but many, those very human skills now are all the more critical. They are the most critical, perhaps. So that gap, I'm concerned, is really just widened. It's like everybody stands around and says, yes, we need to do these things. We value these things. And yet behavior does not reflect this seemingly common belief and understanding. It's quite perplexing to me, actually.
Yeah, it is. It is perplexing to me as well. I don't know if you saw in the last day or two, there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times written by Anish Raman and Maria Flynn. And it's talking about training in an age of AI and the impact on it. And it's talking about some of the same things you're talking about. And they talked about the movement from a goods economy to a knowledge economy, and now from a knowledge economy to a what they refer to as a relationship economy, where the key skills are people skills and social abilities. And it's perplexing, and that resonates with me, and I think it's consistent with what you just said. Why do we have difficulty grappling with that concept in an educational context? I know lawyers are resistant to change. I know law faculty, like Law Partners, are used to doing things a certain way. But it is perplexing to me that people don't see the impact of this technology in the profession in the same way.
So first, I have not read that piece, and I'm going to go immediately find it as soon as our conversation concludes, because I'm intrigued. And I know some folks who I think might need to read it. I think the reasons are multiple. It's multi-layered. It's complex. I think the reasons are largely systemic and then kind of fan out from there. And I do think it goes back to just a really deep comfort level and tradition and for many an appreciation for the way things have always been done. And I can't possibly, you know, do justice to explaining why legal education takes the form it does today. But it does have something to do with this idea and this belief that is entrenched in the legal academy that it is primarily an academic and scholarly pursuit. And so I don't observe, and I do not think the history of the institution reflects a belief that it is a training ground for practical skills. So I think there's one disconnect there, because I also observe, and I think this is reflected in an historical overview, that the folks who embrace this idea that it is an academic pursuit do not view training in those very human and frankly highly practical skills as worthy of that academic pursuit. So I think there's a significant disconnect there. And, you know, let's face it, we graduate thousands of lawyers every year from ABA law schools who go forth into the world and manage to practice law and do good work and do just fine. And so, you know, the idea that somehow this is insufficient or, some believe broken, just doesn't really resonate with many folks. I also, to your point about lawyers and law professors being somewhat change averse, I observe again that for many folks, the way things are work very well for them. And so there is no intrinsic motivation to do anything differently. And for the most part, there's no extrinsic pressure to do anything differently. So I think this is where it gets interesting, because now might be different. If generative AI and what comes next, because I don't think we've seen the last iteration of what artificial intelligence can and will do, but if this technology goes in the direction that many people think it will go in, and which is really foreshadowed by what it's doing now, will that be the extrinsic pressure that heretofore has been either missing or inadequate to really force an evolution, a modernization of both how we train lawyers and what lawyers do? To your point about, will lawyering look different? Will we be doing different things? Will there be a different definition? And so, yeah, I'm so incredibly curious to see what impact this technology ultimately has.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating, because speaking from the practice side of it, it's been sort of an apprentice program where people are trained or work on tasks like reviewing documents or writing briefs or doing those type of things. And it's been assumed that that skill development is what's necessary to become a good lawyer. But if generative AI can do those, and the client pressure is such that they're expecting that work to be done by technology as opposed to individuals, is it going to require a complete rethink of the way we train and develop people to become the full-fledged deliverers of legal judgment and relationships and empathy? I don't know. It's going to be an interesting journey we're on, isn't it?
I absolutely agree. And I think it's going to just be a journey. This is not a situation, in my humble opinion, that we, quote, figure out what we need to change in order to prepare young lawyers to enter the profession in the world you just described, because that target is going to be ever shifting. And so I think that's where probably the most intense discomfort comes from, because if we were talking about solving a static problem, I think folks, while they still wouldn't want to change or really deal with it, I think that's like, okay, we've just got to figure this thing out. And once we do that, we're okay. Like, we're on to the next, you know, the next iteration. We're just going to constantly be iterating. So I can give an example from my school. The co-director of the Vanderbilt AI Law Lab and I, my co-director, Mark Williams, who is also a law librarian at Vanderbilt, as soon as we saw and understood what was happening with ChatGPT, and especially the jump from 3.5 to 4, and really just the shift that technology was taking in a way that was very meaningful for the work of lawyers, we immediately got to work with our dean to develop workshops for our students, for our faculty. We immediately rolled out an AI and law practice course, which we've taught for the past two semesters. And knowing that we're going to do what we're doing now based on what's happening in the world right now, and it's going to be constantly changing. And so what we taught in the fall is different than what we're teaching this spring. What we're going to teach next fall is going to be different than what we're teaching right now. And so the idea that somehow we just need to figure out, quote, what changes we need to make, and once we make those, we'll be good, is really not a sound way to approach the world in which we find ourselves right now. So I think we're really staring at constant iteration. And I think for a profession that trains people to deal with the present and the future by looking in a rearview mirror, that is rightly terrifying.
Yeah, it is terrifying. And it's got to make your challenge even more extreme, because if you think about it, the students who are joining as 1Ls this year are going into practice 3 years from now. given the speed of the technological changes, trying to figure out what the world and the demands are going to be 3 years from now, let alone a year from now, it's almost impossible to do. So you're right, you've got to keep iterating. I think that's a fabulous way to approach it. Tell us a little bit more about the AI lab. What is it? What are you teaching? What's the reaction been to students?
So the Vanderbilt AI Law Lab, otherwise known as VAIL, Vanderbilt loves its acronyms. So of course we have one.
You got to love a good acronym, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, sometimes though they pick acronyms that don't go so well. There's a really funny Twitter thread in which I call out a very questionable acronym that Vanderbilt rolled out during the pandemic. If anybody wants a really good chuckle, just look on Twitter for that. Anyhow, so really all the credit for the lab being a thing in the world right now goes to our dean, Chris Guthrie. Who, by the way, was just renewed for his, I believe, fourth term as our dean. So that's very exciting because he is an incredible supporter of the program on law and innovation, which is kind of the parent of VAIL. But the dean, along with many of us who are kind of have our fingers on the pulse of innovation in law, you know, quickly understood that this technology really seems different and seems much more likely to have a measurable impact. And he really wanted to capitalize. And his approach is also very consistent with a larger university approach and really mission to embrace AI and really leverage it and figure out as we're going along how we can best prepare our students at all levels throughout the university to go forth and be leaders with respect to this technology and the impact it's going to have on all kinds of professions. And so with the dean's leadership, he approached Mark and me and said, I think we should do something. What should we do? And he really gave Mark and me the freedom, the creative freedom to figure out what it could look like. And then he funded it. And so it really was that simple. It came together very quickly, as things should right now. It is an experiment. We have his blessing, the blessing of the university, incredible support across the university, which, by the way, we have an embarrassment of riches across the Vanderbilt campus with respect to all kinds of expertise, both technical and humanistic and legal and philosophical. And so we have all these rich resources, all these people who are interested in collaborating with us to come together. And so the lab itself is really focused on the intersection of AI and making law better. And the lab's mission is to leverage the AI of law to do better, to figure out how we can serve more people, how we can empower people to help themselves. As you know well, we have an alarmingly large and growing justice gap in this country. Anywhere from 70 to 92% of the legal problems experienced in this country at any given moment get no meaningful assistance from a lawyer. And so we believe that there is the opportunity to explore and experiment to use this technology to help us close that gap. And so we're experimenting. That's one of our core purposes, is to bring together people from different disciplines to see how we can leverage the technology to address the growing gap of access to civil justice. Our probably foundational and fundamental mission is to educate. We are in a law school, and so we are developing new curriculum to prepare our students to go forth into the world and be competent with respect to the AI of law, and preparing them to actually lead once they get into the organizations where they're going to go work. Because we think that competency and that knowledge is going to be critical in all kinds of legal organizations. And we want our students to be prepared when they get there and to be confident in that preparation and in that competency. We're also working to develop educational resources, both as a connection point. So we will bring together resources created by others to make it easy for people in the law who want to learn to find good information and good resources to learn. And we're also creating resources that we will share externally so that we can help other people who want to become competent reach that level of competency.
When you talk about people becoming competent in the use of AI, drill down one more level on that, Kat. What does that mean? Is that prompt engineering? Is it development of programs? Is it philosophical? Is it the legal issues associated with AI? When you say competency, what tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think that competency is contextual. What competency means in one role is going to be different than what it means in another. I think we can first look to ABA's Model Rule 1.1, Comment 8, which I think at least 40 jurisdictions have adopted some form of. And it states explicitly that lawyers must keep abreast of the risks and benefits that technology poses for the practice of law as part of their competency obligation. So if we look simply at Comment 8 to Rule 1.1, attorneys, lawyers should understand the risks and benefits that exist in this point in time. As we've discussed, it's evolving technology. So that's not a static competency, right? That's a competency that's going to need to be renewed on a regular basis. You must stay abreast. So I think that's the baseline, that understand there should be a basic understanding of how the technology works so that you understand how it is helpful to the delivery of legal services and the work that a lawyer does and the risk that it poses, specifically those risks that impinge upon our ethical obligations. And so I think that's the foundation on which we build. Certainly, I'm teaching students who are going to go into practice areas that are going to require them to have a much deeper understanding of how the technology works because of the clients they're going to be representing. So just as AI is impacting us, it's impacting industries across the world. And many industries, their business is becoming AI. Their work is being transformed by this technology as well. And so the work done on behalf of these corporate clients is going to also be heavily influenced by the technology. And so it's going to moving from the AI of law into the law of AI, which is not specifically the objective of the lab, but we have a very rich curriculum at Vanderbilt already that addresses those issues that are relevant to the law of AI. And that part of the curriculum is growing as well in reaction to what's happening in the world around us. So I think the foundation, and then it just depends on your role in practice. And some folks are probably going to be able to continue to do what they do by meeting that foundational obligation and just understanding, here's what the technology is, here are ways it can help me, here are the risks I need to be hyper aware of so that I'm not doing bad things. I mean, we can all point to the bad things, right? We've all seen the headlines of the lawyers who've used ChatGPT 3.5 to pull up cases that don't exist and put them in a brief that they filed with the court. I will say, I will urge people to understand that that is bad lawyering. That is not the technology's fault.
That's not a technology problem. You're right.
But that goes to the foundational obligation to be competent with respect to the technology, to understand the risk, right? Anyone who you can spend half an hour reading about the technology and quickly understand that you do not use ChatGPT 3.5 to research case law that you plan to rely on in anything you file with the court. But we also know that it is the ethical obligation of an attorney to check on sources before they cite them to the court, regardless of where they found the source, right?
Whether a human gave it to you or whether a computer gave it to you.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's what shepherdizing is all about, right? So I think that's the foundation. And I don't think that's a super high bar for us to meet, but I do think that bar is going to shift, right? It's going to, based on what the technology, how it evolves and how it grows and how we figure out how to use it. Now, do I believe that we have an ethical obligation to use this technology in ways that makes us better and helps us deliver better services to our clients? Absolutely. I also don't believe that any jurisdiction is going to enforce that kind of obligation on lawyers just across the board. So I don't think you're going to get sanctioned because you're not using the latest form of artificial intelligence in whatever platform. I mean, we can look at the most sophisticated versions right now. You can point to CoCounsel by Casetext, which is now a Thomson Reuters company. It's incredibly expensive Like a lot of law firms with a lot of money choose not to use it because the cost benefit analysis doesn't work for them at this point. So I don't think we're looking at a future that's going to require the use of this technology in a way that makes someone open to some kind of sanction or something. And I think there are also ways that are much more economical that we really are ethically obligated to explore and figure out how to use it, even if, you know, no one's going to, quote, enforce it. I think that's the opportunity we have. And, you know, for those folks who are really curious about it and are open to experimenting and exploring with how they can actually improve not only the quality of their work, but I also think the process of their work. I think it's, you know, we have it's a win-win here. I think there's going to be incredible opportunity here. So I think a lot of it is the choice to make a mindset shift as we approach how we work. I think that's also part of the foundational, I know that's part of the foundational educational component, part of our mission with Vail. I view our mission to impart these critical human mindsets. So our foundational mindsets are curiosity, intellectual curiosity, humble intellectual curiosity, living in the open-mindedness of not knowing enough about anything, along with creativity and radical collaboration. And that is collaboration across disciplines and with technology to do our work better and to help more people. So that's foundational. And I think those mindsets are that's the thing that's going to be static across all of this. As the technology shifts and as that bar goes up, those mindsets are what will serve us. The tech we have to learn, that's going to be constantly changing. That's going to be the dynamic part. And so what are those static foundational skills and mindsets we can impart? And then let's build on that.
Absolutely.
I might have gotten away from your original question. Sorry.
it was fascinating, Kat. It was wonderful as always. I know we've run out of time. I could keep this conversation going forever. One of the things that strikes me, I will make one observation and encourage our listeners to go back and listen to the first time you came on the show, because we talked there about your work with the radiology and radiology services department. And one of the things that strikes me about both your approach as well as Vanderbilt approach, and you mentioned it in the lab, is this cross-disciplinary work that you do, which I find rarer than it should be, but so wonderful when it happens. It's got to be a great part of your job to be able to collaborate with other professionals who are struggling with similar issues in different contexts to learn from them.
Yes. I mean, it's so much fun. It really keeps things so interesting. And I will say, just a data point, and I might have shared this in our last conversation, but there is a growing body of research that shows that when you bring problem solvers together who are trained to solve problems in different ways, you get better solutions and you get them more quickly. So there's data behind this approach. It's not just some frou-frou human-centered design mindset idea. Like, it is based in data, and it's also a whole lot of fun. It really is. So I'm very lucky in that regard.
Well, you're doing some great things. We'll put some things in the show notes, including links back. We didn't even talk about the Delta model, which we talked about in the first one. We'll have to save that for your third time back on the show.
That would be fantastic.
Kat, thank you so much. Great talking to you again.
This has been so much fun. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Pioneers and Pathfinders. Be sure to visit thepioneerpodcast.com for show notes and more episodes. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform.